So today we're going to talk about JavaScript and Ajax. And now we're going to start having some, this is fun. It's kind of sad that we're just starting to have fun and do really nerdy geeky things toward the very end of the class. Although we've been doing nerdy geeky things all along, but now we're going to do magical things. We're doing things that are what make Twitter work and how Facebook, when you see the little thing and you click and it opens something up in the same page and all this high interactivity. This is using a programming language called JavaScript that runs in your web browser and a technique that allows the HTML pages to be dynamically changed while they're sitting in your browser. As always, this material is a copyright Creative Commons. So up to now, we've learned how to, we've learned HTML. We've learned CSS, we've learned how to write flat HTML files, just editing them. Then we've learned how to generate those HTML files with templates and dynamically add material in the server. Now we're going to actually put programming code in the JavaScript. You got to kind of keep your head straight. We've got all these programming things happening. And so the JavaScript is a programming language that runs in the browser while your page is sitting there in the browser. So it's using no server resources except when it actually talks back to the server, which is what Ajax is. Now the name JavaScript is really kind of a stupid name chosen for only marketing purposes. It's really more like the language C than it is like Java, but it came out a year later or a year or so after Java was the big rage and everyone thought this Java thing was the greatest language ever. And so they were going to call it like ActiveScript and they were going to call it a bunch of things, and it didn't take off until they called it JavaScript, right? And it's like, this is like a version, a scripting language that's like Java that runs in the browser. It actually wasn't all that much like Java, but marketing-wise, it caught and everyone got everyone's attention. Now it's really, to me, it's a very amazing language. It usually languages, when they come out, their first version is kind of crappy and we have to fiddle with it. And like Python, there was Python 1, and then shortly thereafter there was a Python 2. Now the Python 2's lasted for almost 20 years. But most languages have kind of this, Java actually, Java 1.0 was actually a complete disaster as a language. A lot of people wrote a bunch of books on Java 1.0. Java 1.1 was non-uppers compatible with Java 1.0, and so literally shelves full of books just were thrown in the trash. And this is 10 years ago now. JavaScript is this language that got it right almost from the beginning. And when it was written, we didn't imagine all the things that we would use it for that we're using it for today. And what's awesome is smart people keep discovering clever new things about JavaScript. They just like, oh, we just figured this out, and this is amazing, and it's been there all along. And so it's really quite a testament to the creators of JavaScript that it was so clever at the beginning that we're still only figuring out its potential. Of course, we're not going to get too advanced in this class, but just it's a language that for me is a really impressive language. Because it's got so many things right, and its potential is just untapped at this point. And as we start seeing CSS 3 and HTML 5, we're just going to start seeing amazing things. Video games written in HTML and stuff like that. It's just going to be just crazy. I love it. So you're learning another programming language. It's a new syntax. It will be a little familiar to you because it looks probably more like CSS than anything else you've done. It uses curly braces to declare begin and end. We indent, but white space doesn't matter. So that's very much like CSS, and we end lines with semicolons. Although there's something in JavaScript about you can omit the semicolons sometimes, but I'm so afraid to not know when I can omit them that I put them in all the time. And so the curly brace is a begin-end indicator. So that's just the beginning and end of a block. And we're not going to learn a lot of JavaScript. You're not going to program any JavaScript. You're mostly going to cut and paste stuff that I give you, and I'm going to explain what it does. But this is not really a JavaScript programming class. And so the most useful line of code in JavaScript is the alert function call. And what the alert function call does is it runs and it makes a pop-up box. Now, why is this the most important thing? And that is because it's hard to debug Java. Now, super smart people, smarter than me, actually have all these cool Java debuggers, and I'm old school. This is an old school way of debugging Java. You stick an alert statement in. And so that's the simplest and most useful JavaScript line of code, and you'll see we use it all the time. And it's a good way to do a sanity check on your JavaScript. You say, and those of you that I've helped, you'll see that when I'm confused, I'll put something silly in code. You know, sometimes I'll even break code to see if it's a syntax error. I'll introduce a syntax error to say, are we working in the right file even? So sometimes you throw this in an alert statement in your JavaScript, just like, is this code running or not? So you just stick an alert statement in and then run it again, and then pop, up comes this little pop-up box. So much like CSS, there are a couple of ways that you can, and CSS and JavaScript kind of came out in very similar time. There are a couple of ways that you can include JavaScript in a page, much like you can include a file in the header, or elsewhere. You can include a file with a URL that has just JavaScript code in it. You can have the JavaScript run inline in the documents, and you can also have JavaScript as an attribute on a tag. So you see kind of the same three patterns that we saw in CSS of from a file, inline code, and right on a tag you can put it. And we'll see all three of these. So here is an example, just like CSS, where we are including a file of JavaScript in the head area. It doesn't have to be in the head area, but it's commonly, lots of stuff are things like setting up functions and loading libraries are often done in the head area of the document. And it's just a script tag, and I never remember what it's supposed to be, so I just go cut and paste from some other thing I did. You tell it it's a JavaScript file, you give it a URL, and then you end your script tag. You can also put it in line. I gotta remind myself. I'll send you an email about this afterwards. So when you put JavaScript inline, it breaks your XHTML or your HTML 4.0 strict compliance, and so you gotta put it inside little comments, and I'll send that pattern around. So all the stuff that I'm about to show you would break in a if you were to go through the HTML validator. But I got to fix these slides so that's correct next time, because these won't validate. So if you go put JavaScript into the validator without adding this little bit of crap to it, it won't validate. But it'll run and won't validate. But your browser has the right to go into Quirks mode if it saw this JavaScript. So the script tag's not the problem. The fact that between the script tag, we change from HTML to JavaScript. So we have to tell HTML, the browser, the HTML validator, to ignore what's in between the script and the slash script. The script tag is fully well-formed, slash script is well-formed, but the yellow bit is not well-formed. But that doesn't matter. What matters is this inline JavaScript is your browser is reading the document, sees the header one, sees the script tag, says, oh, you'd want me to run some JavaScript. So it runs some JavaScript, and then it continues. And so if you run this, and you can type, all these examples are sitting there at www.drchuck.com, JavaScript/1.htm. Let me pop that up. Okay, so the thing that this shows you is this shows you in the middle of a document loading, if we go back to the page, in the middle of the document loading, between the time that the browser is drawing the H1 and the time, the first H1, and then the time the browser is drawing the second H1, the JavaScript is running. It also shows you something about the alert box. The alert box suspends everything. It stops your browser from running. So you're like in a, your browser's sort of like stopped. It is in the middle of displaying that HTML document. So these JavaScript things are running while the document is being loaded and parsed. So where you put it matters. If I'd have put it after the second H1, we would see both H1s before the alert box. Does that make sense? The alert box stops the browser in its tracks. Halfway through, if it's halfway through showing your page, it stops it in its tracks. This is actually kind of valuable sometimes to just know that you can sort of like stop the browser in mid-parse. Okay, so here's something you've actually done already. This onClick, if you want to put, the third way to put JavaScript in an HTML page is you put it in a tag. So if you remember in CSS, we said style equals, and then we could throw some CSS on the attribute. And so here we say onClick. And there's a couple of other things like onHover, onMouseOver, there's a whole bunch of them. I don't remember what they are. onClick is the one that we mostly work with. And we've actually used it already. It's been how we put the cancel button into all of our forms. If you saw, remember that, we'll see that, we'll come up, bring that back. We've been using this all along. I kind of said, just put this cool stuff in and don't worry about it. Now we're going to worry about it and understand it. And so the onClick basically says, this stuff in between these double quotes, that will be JavaScript. So I'm just putting a bit of JavaScript code in this onClick, and that's going to run it when I click. And so here is a little bit of JavaScript, and I've got an A tag, and when I click on it, I'm going to run an alert box. And the other one, I'm going to click on it, and I'm going to pop up an alert box and return false. So let me show you first how that works. Oops, see my browser. So you'll notice I cannot type here because my alert box is here, because my browser is dead to the world at this point. So now my browser finishes. So I'll go to example 2. So if you look at example 2 again, that's just hrefs with onClick attributes on each of the hrefs. And so if I click on plan A, it's going to run the onClick code. Okay, so what I did in the onClick is I had an alert box that said, ouch, there's the alert box. Now when I say okay, you'll notice that my page goes to University of Michigan. And that's because I did this on a tag, that it was an anchor tag that went to University of Michigan, right? So the JavaScript runs, and then when the JavaScript finishes by me clicking on this OK button, it actually follows the href. And that's the purpose of adding return false. This return false in the second example says, you know what, I'm the JavaScript, I've run, once I've run, don't do what you were about to do. If it doesn't return false, it goes ahead and does the href, but you can stop it from doing what it would normally do if it weren't for this JavaScript. So it suppresses whatever it was going to do. So if I do the click to plan B, it pops up an alert box, but then as soon as I say OK, the JavaScript continues, and that return false is going to happen. And so it says, you know what, I've taken care of this. You're really telling the browser not to do what the href would have done by itself. Whereas if I don't say return false, this will return, but not return false. It follows the link. And you can use these on like form submit buttons, and HAs, and these, each of these sort of have some default action. Like when you press on a submit button, normally it submits a form, but you can make it so that when you press a submit button in a form, it actually runs some JavaScript, and then you tell the browser, oh, and by the way, I took care of everything. Don't submit the form for me. Take care of that. So that's what this, you'll see this a lot in onClick methods, this return false. Right, it's like, I took care of it. Everything's handled. Ignore this. And you'll see this in an example Any questions? Okay. So another just pattern that's common that you will see is there's a special attribute on the body tag called onload, and that also runs some JavaScript. And what this basically says is, unlike when you run JavaScript in the middle of the document, it stops the document loading. What this says is, finish document loading and then run my JavaScript. Okay? So that means that the whole document is displayed and it runs the JavaScript. So let me show you how that one works. That one's 3. Okay, so the page is done. It called when it hit the sort of slash body and rendered the whole page, then it finished. Okay, so that's another pattern that you'll see in JavaScript, is JavaScript that is included in the head. We're defining a function in the head, which actually doesn't call the function, right? It's like def main in your Python. The actual call to main is main parentheses. The def main just defines it. So that defines the function in the head. So the pattern that you've seen already and have been using all along is this one, where we have input type equals submit, name equals login, and then input type equals button, onClick. So the problem is this input type equals button would actually submit the form. And so that's where we have to return false. Now window.location, this is calling some JavaScript to change. It's like typing slash into the URL field. Okay? And so it's a way to say, here I'm going to make a button that's in a form. It looks like a form button. It's not really going to submit the form at all because I'm returning false, but it is going to set my window location back. So let me show you how that works. So here's the chat game that we're going to be playing in the second half of the lecture. So I go into the login, and it's this cancel button. So if I view source, and I go down and look at the form, so you'll notice that I've got an input type of submit, which is the login, which actually is when the form is going to be submitted. Right, so input type equals submit, that's this login button, that's a real form submit. The cancel, on the other hand, when I click on cancel, it's going to go to the slash URL and then return false, which means don't submit the form. From a Python perspective, so we have the login handler, and the login handler would take that post. Okay, the login will submit the form, which causes a post to the login handler, whereas the cancel will do a get to slash, because it's just going to change the URL. It's like you go up in the top and you type the URL. And the same thing when I did the apply, right? It just says go to slash apply. So that causes a get request to slash apply, right? And if you look at this, create cancel, it'd be the same. Cancel will cause a get request slash, whereas create will cause a post request to the whatever it's called, probably apply handler, whatever I called it, right? And so this is coming from that post method. But when I hit cancel, it's not submitting the form. That's what this return false is all about, to suppress the default behavior of whatever thing you're clicking on. So somebody's clicked on something, and I return false to keep it from submitting the form. So this would be very confusing if I didn't put return false. It would both submit the form, and then it would change the window location, which probably would leave us at the, it probably would mean that we would just stay at the same form. Any questions on return false? Okay.
Okay. So, the next thing to talk about is the document object model. So, when your browser, up to now, I say the request response cycle is you send a GET request or a POST request, and then the server sends you back some stuff, and then your browser displays it. Well, as a side effect of your browser displaying that return document, it creates a thing called a document object model. And for those of you who are in 502 or have had 502, this is kind of a throwback to XML. So in XML, you had this structure with all this tree stuff, and a document object model allows you in JavaScript to treat the entire web page kind of like a hierarchy of XML fields. And so JavaScript is able to touch any part of the live web page by looking at the document model. And this is where the ID attribute actually comes in mighty handy. Up till now, we primarily used the ID attribute to mark the for CSS so that we could put colors on and stuff like this. But we can also use the ID attribute as a way to look up an item. So this bit of code that we've already been using and talked a little bit about, this window.location is actually part of the document object model. That is, go into the window and find sort of the child element, location, and change that value in the document model to be slash. That is the same as changing it with your own typing in the URL screen. Okay, so go into the document model at window.location and change that variable to be slash. And then return false, of course, means do not submit the form. So here's a bit of code that we'll play with now. Wow, we can't really see it. I wonder why. Oh, no better. I'll just move it in the slides. Okay. So here is a bit of JavaScript code that is going to deal with the document object model. So here we have an href, and if you see increasingly you start seeing things like buttons and anchor tags as running JavaScript rather than being links. And the convention is when you really don't want that link to go ever anywhere, you say pound sign is the href. That's kind of like stay here. And it sort of saves us from having to do a return false in the JavaScript. So I've got an onClick method. And so the document object model, accessing the document object model, the HTML bits of it, starts with document. And then we're going to call a method inside the document object model, because it's object-oriented where you have both data and methods all kind of put together. So we're going to call this method called getElementById. That's a defined part of the document model. And then that takes one parameter, and that parameter is, it's going to look for any tag with the ID of stuff. Now if you recall, you can only have one ID per one specific ID per document. So class, you can have as many tags that have a class equals X on them, but you can only have one ID equals X. So this getElementById says there's exactly one, zero or one stuffs in this document, zero or one tags with an ID of stuff on them in this document. We're going to get it. And then once we get that item, so that is a selector, think about that very much like a CSS selector to say, it's kind of like saying pound sign stuff in CSS. Pound sign stuff, go find the tag that has an ID of stuff, and that's what this little green bit says, and then change its HTML, set its inner HTML as the HTML itself, which means it's the inner HTML is changing this bit rather than the entire thing. Change the HTML between that tag to be this string. It's probably easier if I show you this. Oops. Probably should have showed you. So, this is the bit of the document that I marked with ID equals stuff. Here is, when I click on back, that is going to go look up the piece of the document that has the ID of stuff and set its inner HTML to the string BACK. So there is no request response cycle happening here. The browser is seeing a click, you've got an onClick method, and that onClick method is going to run some JavaScript, and that JavaScript is going to change the document that's in your browser right this minute. So I changed the document. Okay? So I've changed the document. The document is changed. And then I can change it to fourth.
Questions?
Yeah. This is a good time for questions. That's because I was probably testing them. Oh, good. Because their hrefs are both pound sign. So even though that href is kind of meaningless, right, the browser is keeping track of something. And I could probably have 30 things that were all href pound sign. Now, so there's no request response cycle. That's a key here. And this can allow web applications to become very high performance. So, for example, when you're in Facebook and you switch and you go to chat and that little window slides up, it's not redisplaying the whole screen. It's actually playing with the document object model, the document model, and playing with it and adding bits and pieces to it dynamically without actually redrawing the whole screen. And so Facebook can really tune its performance because I can hit this a million times and it's costing me no server load, it's costing you no network traffic. The only thing that's working here is the microprocessor in your laptop when your browser is doing it. So one of the things that they do is they try to get to the point where they move some of the server load into your browser using this. They're programming your browser, and they're using the power of your browser. Now, you can abuse this and get in trouble where you're actually, well, we haven't got to Ajax yet. So you can get in trouble, but what I'm showing here is actually free. If you as a programmer can create your web application and efficiently use JavaScript and nothing else, that is a free thing. And so, just sort of as an example, something I'm going to do next semester, you may have seen my SI791 announcement. So, one of the things I'm going to do in the next version of Sakai is if you go to SI539 and you go to resources, that is a full request response cycle plus about 20 other things. And then if I go back to home, that's another 20 or so full request response cycles. There's a request response, and there's a request response. So what I'm going to do in the next version of Sakai, which will probably be here not fall of this year, but fall of next year, because that's how long it takes for them to trust the modifications that I make. They have to go through a lot of quality assurance before they actually run the code I write. But one of the things that I expect you'll see in the fall of 2012 in CTools is there will be no request response cycle when you go back and forth between any of these tools. There will be one request response cycle the first time you go to the tool, and then I will change the document object model to hide and reveal as you navigate back and forth. And you see this stupid drop down? How many people think that that's like an awesomely great user experience? I agree with all of you, actually. I think it's a horrible user experience. That's not going to be there. There's going to be a button. These things aren't even going to be here in the next version. There's going to be a button called My Sites. It's going to look sort of like this, but it's going to bring it up in sort of a page view that you can scroll back and forth on it, and you can move them up and down. And it's going to all be JavaScript so that you can switch to your course page and go back to the course you were from to your course, and that will also be JavaScript too, so I'm reducing the load on the server. Okay? So these are tricks that we do as web developers to reduce the load on our server by making your browsers do some of the display work. Now, you can get in trouble. I mean, you can get a little too excited about this stuff and cause... There's a difference between using the JavaScript in the browser and then using the JavaScript in the browser to make even more server calls. And so if you go to Facebook, it's always dangerous to bring up Facebook in front of a crowd, but I have good friends. So let's see if my daughter's put up, I was going to say, see if I can find a kitty video. And not surprisingly, there is commentary about cats in my Facebook. Not surprisingly. Okay. So this chat, when that rolls up, that was JavaScript, but it was also talking to the server. And when I click on this, you'll watch the little... You'll watch the little thing that goes back and forth. And so at the moment it goes from what you see, the little thing going back and forth, that's JavaScript running in your browser, and then it starts up another request to fill in the space. So that, now that's actually gotten more data, okay? So, but you see, I don't know why she posted. Oh, I know. It's open house for that group tonight. That's why. That's why she posted that. Okay. But you see this all the time. And so what I want to do is I want to be able to move back and forth between things like status and newsfeed without actually going back and forth for a whole full request response cycle in some upcoming version of CTools. And that's what I'm going to hack all winter long in my SI-791 class. And that's why I need a bunch of people with usability skills in my 791 class. Yeah?
Have you thought about adding mobile support?
It's already there. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I added mobile support to CTools like 2 years ago. You just go to /PDA. Now what you'll see in the next release is that's going to look like totally, totally sexy. It doesn't look sexy. This is the one I wrote. It's not very cool, but you can see here's my course. Here's the resources. Let me show you. See if I can show you the new one. So that's the new one. So that's the next release that'll probably be here this fall, next fall. So that's the new, we got a CSS guy. I think we don't have time in five, wait a sec, what class is this? This is 539, yeah. If we had another week, I would bring you in the guy that, I would bring you in the guy that built this. He's like the most amazing CSS guy on the planet. Okay, so that's the new, that's falls, or maybe even be winter. They might be trying to get this in for winter. It's in the next release of Sakai, but we at Michigan sometimes pull stuff from the next release. Usually if I didn't write it, they trust it more, and so they pull it in. When I wrote it, they wait like a year to pull it in. Okay, so that's the new PDA portal, and it looks quite beautiful. I'll make him come and do a guest lecture about this in my SI-791 class. That's what I'll do. Because you have to sort of be advanced to understand all the stuff. He starts talking and you sort of have to keep up. Okay. Let's see. Where was I? Okay, back and forth. Now you'll notice in the back and forth, you notice in back and forth that I can't get it to what it was before. Now I could write some JavaScript to set it back to stuff, but if I refresh the page and do a request response cycle, I get it back to its original state. Okay? And so, and then here's the other thing that's kind of weird. So I'm going to click on back, and now I'm going to do a view source. And this will drive you nuts. Because the source, the original source of the document, is not showing you the new change stuff. It's still showing you what came back. Oops, come back. Right? And the way, Firefox is so slow, but the way you actually can see it in Firefox is there is this way, no. Okay, so here we go with Firefox, the same thing. And so on Firefox, I can do the same thing, back and forth and back and forth. And then I can, oh, where is it? Where is it? What am I looking for? Well, there it is. Okay, so way over here in Firefox, way over here. My screen's too small. Way over here in Firefox, there's a. In, if you put the web developer plugin in, you can see this thing called View Generated Source, which is different. Here's View Source, which shows what came from the server, and then View Generated Source shows it as being displayed. So if you want to debug your stuff, the JavaScript that's messing with your document model, you've got to go and view generated source. There's other ways to do it as well, but that's the quickest way to do it. One error. Yeah, that doesn't mean anything. Okay. So this bit is about reaching into the document model, much like we do with CSS, and then doing something to that bit of the document model. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So here's another thing that you got to get used to. Kind of like Quirks mode and kind of like CSS, the browser is not very talkative about JavaScript errors. It will generally not complain to you when you have a syntax error in JavaScript. And so here's a piece of JavaScript that misspells the alert box. So let's go run it. That's number 5. Whoa, make it a little smaller there. So there we are. We saw no alert box. We saw nothing. It's like we're crazy. We put that alert in. So if we view source, we say like, what do you mean? I got some JavaScript. And it's right here, and it's right in the middle. Like, what's going on? I mean, the good news is you didn't get a trace back. The bad news is that you didn't get a trace back. The problem is they just don't think for usability purposes that it's all that useful if you're in the middle of the Yahoo page to have a bunch of errors popping up. So it just eats the errors and dies silently. But you as a developer, you need to see these, okay? And so you're scratching your head and you're saying, what is wrong? And so there's a different place in each of the, where are we at? Developer. So you can turn on in Safari this developer thing, and I can show my error console. So now it's giving me this error console, and it's saying, in 5.htm on line 7, there's a syntax error, and I can even click on it here, and it will say, dude, there's a syntax error. So there's actually useful tools to help you find these JavaScript errors, but you have to go looking for them. The browser is not going to throw tracebacks because of bad JavaScript and reveal them to your end user. Your pages just stop working when you have JavaScript syntax errors. So again, it's like CSS, where you can if you don't know what to look for, you can spend hours looking at something thinking, I'm crazy. And then you throw it in the validator and you got this little missing semicolon or something. And so JavaScript errors are something you have to go hunt down and look for. So Firebug also gives you a way to look at these errors. If you pop the Firebug console up, you can see its console, and it will also show you the errors. Let me go to Firefox, not Chrome, Firefox. So Firefox probably has a couple of ways to show this, but if you're using Firebug, and I go to http://www.drchuck.com. Whoa, there's two syntax errors in that one. So I go to drchuck.com, I bring up Firebug, I look in the console, and here it is telling me what's going on, what line's wrong, everything basically. Okay? So you can find them. They're pretty easy to find. You just have to know enough to look for them. And this is where, even if I turn Firebug off, oh, it didn't even tell me. It showed with Firebug on, it showed me that there was an error. So it alerted me there. And again, I didn't just make all these decisions, but I think browser designers have basically said, let's not overload the user with all kinds of programmer debugger information. And they're probably right, but it is frustrating as a developer. You can also, in the Firebug In Firebug, you can also look at the DOM yourself. So you'll notice there's this little tab called, well, let me go back to 4 for fun. So here's the DOM. I'm going to move this up a bit. And so this is the document object model, and you can sort of debug it. So if you see here, we can see window. And under window, we can see location. Right? So that's the location. Now the interesting thing is we can change these things. I'm not going to change that particular one right now. So there's window.location. Window's kind of the part outside the document. I'll close window for the moment. And I will go to document. So document is the HTML bit. And then I'm going to go inside a body. And then I'm going to go in the P tag. Oh boy. There we go. I'm getting to it. No, we still got to keep going to the child. There we go. So this is the inner HTML. Stop. So this... No! I just had it. Oh, no. Okay, well, too painful. Eventually, I could click on this and actually change it. Right? So that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to get down to the point where I could change it. You can actually change it, and it'll change up there. But I'm not going to... I don't spend much time in this. Okay? So you can see the entire document object model, and it can help you when you're writing code. Oh, here's something. No, okay, I don't want to confuse you. Or myself. Okay, so you can explore the document object model, and you can even change the document object model. People who spend time in CSS and HTML, they just fiddle with it all the time. So the first part of this lecture is JavaScript itself. And basically, it's a really powerful language. The fact that the browser is completely programmable and you have full access to the HTML in the browser means that increasingly lots of cool applications are starting to just run code in the browser. And people just go become professional JavaScript developers. JavaScript is becoming so popular that it's even becoming a server language in addition to a browser-based language. And so there's now some cross-compilers that will compile JavaScript and let you run it in the server. So JavaScript allows us to program in the browser. And what you've seen so far is just me manipulating the DOM, the document object model. Now what we're going to do is we're going to actually talk to the server and then manipulate the DOM, both talk to the server and manipulate the DOM using a technique that's called AJAX, which stands for Asynchronous JavaScript and XML. So the idea originally when they first came up with this idea was, is we've got JavaScript, why don't we let JavaScript make its own connections while a page is loaded and replace a portion of the page. And so in the good old days, and frankly everything we've done up till now, when you click on something, it triggers a request response cycle. Browser makes a TCP/IP connection, sends the post or the get request, the server grinds through some work, and then sends back some HTML to be displayed. And then you just repeat this over and over and over. Every click causes a request response cycle. So you can think of this as from the browser to the server, a get request, a page comes back, and the whole page is redrawn. Another click, a get request, the whole page comes back, and it's redrawn. Right? Click, request, response, draw. Wait. Oop, click something else, request, response. Wait. Click, request, response. Click, wait, request, response. So we just got done learning this. Well, if you enable JavaScript with the ability to actually make its own connections to the server, you end up with a bit of a different pattern. Now, the notion of this AJAX wasn't a foregone conclusion. I'm not sure anyone really had it in mind when JavaScript was built, when CSS was built. And so the story of how we got AJAX is a bit of a strange story. In the late 90s, Microsoft was trying to build web-based versions of Microsoft Outlook. So everyone's trying to build the best, the absolute best user experience. Because in 1998, if you were using the web, there was no drag and drop, there was no Gmail, there was no Google Maps, there was no whatever. Everything was just clickety-clickety, and that's how you had to click and redraw the whole page. And Microsoft decided that they wanted to create a better user experience for their customers. And so they decided that in order to create a in-the-browser email reading and experience that allowed dragging and dropping, they were going to have to extend their browser to allow JavaScript to make web connections in JavaScript without forcing a whole page redraw. And so they built a version of Microsoft Outlook for the browser, and they added an extension to Internet Explorer called XML HTTP Request. So only in the Internet Explorer browser, they had a thing where they could pull back a part of a page and use the existing capabilities that we just shown with inner HTML and JavaScript to replace bits and pieces dynamically. And so this allowed highly innovative user experience for people who are using Internet Explorer talking to the Outlook server over the web. Now, what Microsoft also did was they also created a crappy version of this same thing that required lots of clicks in non-Microsoft browsers. And the idea was that the whole world would see the glory of how wonderful Microsoft browsers were and just stop using Netscape and other browsers and just convert completely to Microsoft and convert completely to Microsoft Exchange and Outlook for all of their mail in 1999. And we all thought that was a pretty good idea back then. And but that's not what the market did. The market looked at this, and the nerds of all the other browser companies said, wow, that's a pretty cool feature. I can add that exact same feature to my browser. And so Microsoft had this advantage for about 3 months. And then every other browser implemented the same basic idea. And so that's when things like Gmail could happen. And Microsoft got no benefit from this, and theirs was a little incompatible with everybody else's. And so Microsoft invented this thing, and it pretty much, if you think about it, it was the thing that made Gmail possible. If Microsoft had not invented this in an attempt to fragment the market, Gmail would not exist, because we weren't thinking about this. Microsoft came up with this idea. But once they came up with the idea, everyone ripped it off. And it wasn't the browser manufacturers that made Gmail, but once this capability was in all the browsers, Google made Gmail, and Google made Google Maps, and half a dozen of Google Docs. All these things depend on the ability for the browser to make requests in JavaScript in the background. So the ironic thing is that Microsoft did this to sort of cement themselves as the top dog, and what they really did was sowed the seeds for possibly the ultimate demise of the desktop operating system. But that's interesting. Microsoft has a history of innovating where their intentions are imperialistic, and the result is amazing because we just rip them off. You know, we just re-implement what they do and use it for different means. But Microsoft has regularly innovated in the web marketplace. We just kind of hate them and re-implement their stuff some other way. But we got to give them credit where credit is due, because they've done a lot of innovation. So with this new pattern, instead of going back and forth to the server on every change in the user interface, we do a request response to get the whole page, but then at some point JavaScript catches some on-click-like action, and instead it goes and gets a little bit of data in the background. That's why it's called asynchronous. And then it updates a part of the screen. And so that's when you see the Facebook with the little dit-dit-dit things happening, or the little spinny things happening. The spinny things are happening during this period where it's waiting for something to happen. And it's telling you and giving you a visual clue at the point where it's waiting for something to happen. And then you click somewhere else, and that causes some more JavaScript to run, which makes its own request response cycle. Now, from the point of view of the server down here, it's just still seeing request responses. It's still seeing request responses, okay? But in the point of view of the user, it's not that different, except that it's a little more the softer user experience, because only a little bit of the screen shows up. So this is where I'm saying, what I showed you in the first part of this lecture was pure JavaScript that had no server impact. The key problem is some folks will turn something that could be one or two request response cycles into 40 or 50 of them, and that actually increases server load rather than decreases server load. So you have to be subtle as to how you use this. But the basic pattern of updating a piece of the screen on a user action, updating a different piece of the screen, or just, you know, checking how many logged in friends you have in Facebook and changing the little number in the lower right hand corner without you doing anything, is also doing XHTML request on a timer. Okay? Any questions? So after the thing, Microsoft did it and everyone sort of ripped it off, and Google Mail came out and people go like, holy crap, you can do pretty amazing things. It's really set off for the last 4 or 5 years an arms race as to who could make the coolest, most amazing website. And really, HTML5, which will come out soon, it's starting to come out, but it'll be kind of standardized enough. They're taking a long time to standardize HTML5 because they know they can't, once you make a standard, you can't fix it, so they're holding off on finalizing the standard. But basically, HTML5 is the full realization of super CSS, super JavaScript, XHTML request, and all these things. And so we just, it's really what, and you know, literally, you know, iPhones and the iPhone UI and the Palm Pre UI, they're all very JavaScript-based. And it's really just transformed what we can possibly do on the internet. It's very amazing. So in the standard request response, each click presents a new screen. In AJAX, we get one screen, but then get partial screens from that point forward. So we can architect our applications quite differently, and we can utilize the power that's sitting in your browsers and the extremely fast compute in your browsers. And that's the other thing that's happening. Since this started, the speed of JavaScript has had to go up, because as web designers put more and more of their functionality into JavaScript code that's running on your laptop, it can slow down. And sometimes you will be sitting in a browser and you'll see the spinning wheel of slow death because your browser is running too much JavaScript at that point in time if you're running an old browser. And so this was one of the reasons that Google actually wrote Chrome. I claimed that the purpose of Chrome back a couple years ago when they brought it out was to put out a threat that if the other browser manufacturers didn't write fast JavaScript, that Chrome would take over the world. Everyone wrote fast JavaScript and Chrome still took over the world. So Chrome is becoming, I heard just last night that Chrome passed Firefox, which, like, I don't get it. It's just like the world, it's part of the world, like, oh man, gravity's going up now. What's going on with that? But that's how it is. Everything that you think is the permanent truth, the permanent truth can change. So, so the next thing that happened, and the thing we'll cover in the next part of the lecture, is as browsers became more powerful, as the JavaScript became more efficient, as our laptops became faster, as software developers making websites increasingly put some of the computational load of your display into your computer, it was only natural that AJAX libraries would start to be developed. And there's been a bit of a war among the AJAX libraries, and this one's quite a religious war. So if you go and you talk to someone who's a Scriptaculous fan and you say, yo, Scriptaculous sucks, jQuery is the way, they'll punch you in the face. Or if you say, jQuery sucks, prototype's the answer, they'll punch you in the face, right? So these people are very passionate about their libraries because we're in the very early days of libraries. It was worse like 3 years ago than it is now. Most people are starting to use jQuery as the library. It's the one that's, you sort of have this pre-Cambrian explosion where you create many things and they have to kill each other, and then finally one has gotten enough ahead of the others that we stop inventing new ones. And so jQuery is what we teach, what I put in the book, because jQuery kind of is the de facto standard for these libraries, and all the Scriptaculouses and the prototypes and the what's it called, DOM, or, oh, I don't know, whatever. There's another one. And they've got passionate people, but they started out too early. They should give up and just use jQuery. I'm very lazy, and I'm a late adopter. I haven't changed my text editor in 25 years, so that shows just how often I jump. The other thing that's kind of interesting, and we talked about this with Mike Ellich at the beginning about accessibility. Accessibility is quite important. And one of the interesting things that's been going on, and Mike alluded to this, and Mike showed you some demos, is that just at the point where we got good at accessibility for fixed HTML documents in the request response cycle, now we've got these freaking JavaScript stuff changing the document just continuously. Where do you read? What part do you read? And that's what Mike was showing you. And so there's a lot of actual research and evolution of the screen reader software to understand these dynamically changing pages. And in a way, it's kind of surprisingly good how quickly the screen reader software has adapted to this. Because screen reader software used to like never change, and the developers had to change. And I thought, oh wow, this Ajax is never gonna work with screen readers. But the world wanted to switch to it, and so the screen readers switched as well. So there's a lot of effort going on in the study of how Ajax can affect accessibility in a positive and a negative way. And this is just this project called the Fluid Project at University of Toronto. Matter of fact, I'm going to visit those people on Monday. Won't be here. I'll be in Toronto on Monday, hanging out with some of my University of Toronto pals. Okay,